This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, ISIS may have lost its territory in the Middle East, but that's not the same as being defeated. Our reporter is in northern Syria and hears the grim truth.
IS fighters are managing to make it through the checkpoints that protect the Kurdish cities. The threat is bigger than before. Every day there are IS attacks on this region. Every day we are arresting IS sleeping cells.
The cladding insurance crisis is firmly in the spotlight today with a meeting of federal and state ministers, but the expectations of a solution appear very low. Since the devastating inferno at the Grenfell Tower in London, buildings across Australia have been found to be covered with flammable material. But adding to the cost of removing it is the refusal of most insurers to provide cover for potential disasters. Alexandra Beach reports.
When Andy White bought his inner Melbourne apartment, it came with a certificate of compliance.
You know, as far as we were made aware, we were buying a perfectly safe product.
But after a year, a fire broke out in one of the units and quickly jumped to the floor above. The building was covered in the same flammable cladding used on the Grenfell Tower in London. The units lost their value and getting property insurance became near impossible.
They've gone up about 400% and at excess is about $100,000. Not allowed to have barbecues on the balcony, not allowed to smoke cigarettes on the balcony.
With hundreds of buildings across the country in similar circumstances, federal and state ministers are meeting today to try to fix compliance and regulation gaps in the construction industry. They asked experts to review these issues after the tragedy at Grenfell and received a report back highlighting significant and concerning problems. But 18 months later, there's still no consensus on the best path forward. Some states are focusing on flammable cladding, others on improving enforcement.
They've all been doing something, but not enough and not quick enough.
Danita Warne is the Chief Executive of Master Builders Australia, one of several industry bodies attending today's meeting. She wants the report's 24 recommendations to be implemented straight away and says the onus is on the states to do that.
They need to put the interests of the public and the industry before any political fighting.
The Federal Industry Minister Karen Andrews is adamant the states have caused these problems and need to fix them. In a statement, she says today is a chance for them to demonstrate their commitment to a nationally consistent building sector. She'll again offer to fund a task force that would work with the states to implement the recommendations, which Danita Warne says is a good approach.
Is simply for a specific purpose to ensure that there is accountability and transparency in the implementation of a report.
But several Labor states think the meeting should focus on professional indemnity insurance instead. Premiums are soaring and exclusions have been added to policies because of concerns about flammable cladding. Queensland's Housing Minister Mick de Brenny says the public doesn't want another layer of bureaucracy. He wants to focus on sorting out the insurance sector and a ban on flammable cladding. While AM understands some states would like the proposed task force to focus on insurance instead, Campbell Fuller from the Insurance Council says that would be a mistake.
This is actually a building and construction industry crisis. Insurance is simply the canary in the coal mine here. Looking for quick fix solutions to the provision of insurance doesn't fix the underlying issues, and that is that there is not enough confidence in the building industry at the moment, and that the regulatory and compliance regimes in each jurisdiction need to be fixed.
That's the Insurance Council spokesman Campbell Fuller ending that report from Alexandra Beach. 4 months after the Islamic State group lost the last piece of its caliphate, attacks by the extremist group are becoming more frequent. Insurgents are mounting daily attacks against Kurdish troops and civilians right across Syria's northeast. Here's Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey.
This car bomb outside a church in the Kurdish city of Qamishli injured 11 people and reflects a worrying new phase of a campaign by the Islamic State group. IS rarely reached this far north during the 5 years it held significant parts of Syrian territory. This is the second bombing in Qamishli in just 2 weeks, and it follows an IS arson campaign that's targeted crops ready for harvest, an economic loss to the Kurds of almost $40 million. Mustafa Bali, a spokesman for the Syrian Democratic Forces, said the group's loss of its physical caliphate means little. The threat is bigger than before. Every day there are IS attacks on this region. Every day we are arresting IS sleeping cells. A recent SDF operation involving 1,000 troops targeted IS insurgents in Deir ez-Zor province, a sparsely populated Arab region that includes Euphrates River villages like Baguz and Hajin that were held by IS until earlier this year. We had an operation in Deir ez-Zor and Hasaka. We were able to arrest sleeping cells, which includes foreign fighters. IS fighters are managing to make it through the checkpoints that protect the Kurdish cities. Late last month, an attacker on a motorcycle detonated a suicide bomb just a few hundred metres after passing through a checkpoint. He targeted the first large group of people he came to, locals buying bread at a roadside bakery. We visit one of the victims, a Qamishli Arab woman called Corween. 2 weeks after the attack, she's still bedridden in her family's front room. I was on the street when suddenly I heard an explosion. Everyone was running, so I fled too. I didn't feel anything at first on my body, only some pain in my shoulder. It stopped me from breathing. They took me to the hospital, and I found I could not breathe. It was very tough. US President Donald Trump announced last year that the fight against IS was all but over and troops crucial to the coalition mission against the extremists would be withdrawn. That sparked horror both inside northeast Syria and in the Pentagon, and the plan's been shelved. US Special Forces are still operating here. Australia has announced expanded air support for the coalition mission until at least the end of 2020. This is Adam Harvey in northeast Syria for AM.
And thanks for your company on AM this morning, where it is 7 past 8. The National Energy Regulator is releasing a plan today that's designed to cut the use and cost of power and prevent blackouts. It'll allow big businesses like aluminium smelters and cold storage warehouses to cut their power usage at peak times and sell it back into the grid. The proposal comes as regulators consider contingency plans for the looming closure of one of New South Wales's largest and oldest coal-fired power stations. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
One of Australia's big electricity users, BlueScope, is turning to solar energy to help power its steelmaking.
We have come down to Finlay today to see the solar farm in the flesh.
BlueScope has also been backing changes at the Australian Energy Market Commission that would see businesses make money by offloading electricity. Tennant Reid from the Australian Industry Group says it would work by businesses such as cold storage warehouses making sacrifices during summer.
They may be able to turn off or turn down their refrigeration system for a couple of hours and have so much thermal inertia in the system that the temperature of their products stays in the range that it's meant to without any further power.
The draft rule being released today by the Australian Energy Market Commission is designed to reduce power use and the price. It goes beyond the usual on and off peak power rates by allowing businesses to start selling their excess energy at any time. The proposed changes are being called a wholesale demand response, and it's something that Dan Cass from the Australia Institute says is long due.
This is a really landmark reform of the national electricity market. It's been on the cards for many years, even decades, this idea of a two-sided market where demand response can bid in megawatts at the same time as generators bid in megawatts, and the cheaper source wins, and the cheaper source sets the price for the whole market.
Today's draft rule allows new third-party providers to come in and start buying and selling the excess power. The National Energy Regulator has put the plan out for consultation and will make a decision by the end of the year on whether to start the changes. At the moment, the focus is on letting businesses sell excess power into the grid, but a household review is also coming. Craig Memory from the Public Interest Advocacy Centre represents consumers.
Households will still benefit from lower prices, even though they can't participate directly, because the large energy users that can participate will be competing with generators in the wholesale market and producing, if you like, negawatts instead of megawatts, And they're doing that for a lower price than the generators.
Mr. Memory hopes that electricity prices will drop by up to 25%, but it's just an estimate. It's still not known exactly what difference to power bills the proposed changes will bring.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting there. The UN Special Rapporteur for Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston, is visiting Australia. He recently delivered a stark warning about the world's inaction on climate change, saying, "Globe's at risk of climate apartheid." The professor, who was born and raised in Melbourne, is back in Canberra, where tomorrow he'll be awarded an honorary doctorate at the ANU, where he used to lecture. And yes, the surname might sound familiar. He is the brother of Richard Alston, the former Federal Liberal Communications Minister. Professor Philip Alston joined me earlier. Philip Alston, welcome to AM. You recently warned about a climate apartheid around the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think what we're seeing in terms of the increasingly dramatic impact of climate change is that it is affecting far more significantly those who are not well off. Certainly internationally, we know that a lot of the areas that are being hit the worst are poorer developing countries. They will bear something like 75% of the brunt. But there's also a strong domestic dimension of that apartheid effect, where the wealthy are pretty much convinced that they will be able to shield themselves in one way or another. They'll be able to move to higher land, they'll have reserves that will look after them, they'll get more air conditioning or whatever. And it's the worse off who are going to be dramatically hit by climate change. Those are the people who have no reserves, whose housing is very fragile, who have no general support system and who will be knocked out by climate change events.
And you've been very critical, not only of corporates, but also of sort of non-government agencies too, and not sort of making the case for these people. Why do you think that is? Are they in a form of denial, or don't they understand the science?
It's complex why it is that we're all sleepwalking into this disaster. Obviously, it varies. Corporate interests, in many cases, have very strong financial self-interest, and so they're just not prepared to look to the future. The fossil fuel industry worldwide gets over $5 trillion a year in subsidies, so there's a good reason for them to be very short-sighted and uninterested. I've also been critical of the human rights community, which is not yet fully engaged with this. Amnesty International is about to, but groups like Human Rights Watch are still dithering on the fence, despite the fact that human rights are going to be dramatically affected by climate change.
Conservative political figures, especially here in Australia, often say that scientists who warn about climate change are being alarmist and that the climate has always been changing. What do you make of those arguments?
I think it's sort of tragic if you actually follow what comes out of the Fox News and related sources. Their trotting out of alternative voices is just so pathetic and so clearly unconvincing, and that for conservative politicians to then parrot that line is really shocking. It'd be fascinating to ask some of those politicians, if they were getting serious medical care for a chronic condition, would they go with the 97% of the experts, or would they say, no, there are alternative voices out there and the tiny 3% or whatever, I think I'll go with them. They wouldn't go near them, but that's what they're doing on climate change.
In Australia, the three-phase personal income tax package recently passed the federal parliament here amid a very sharp debate about what it would mean for the rich and poor. What do you make of the package?
I think it's really a very bad policy initiative. I think to tie one's hands some years in advance without knowing what the situation will be is very bad. But much more concerning to me is the fact that what you're doing is hollowing out government. Clearly, the sort of tax cuts that are envisaged in phase three are going to have a huge impact on the government's ability to provide protection for the broader community, to be able to respond to climate change, for example, but also to ensure a functioning healthcare system. this is all being mortgaged, and the impact that the phase three cuts will have will be highly significant.
Governments, plural in Australia, have been pretty much focused on trying to return the budget to a surplus budget. The New Start payment here for the unemployed hasn't really changed in 25 years, and that has happened under both major parties. What do you make of that?
I think that's also consistent. It's the sort of approach that I saw in the United Kingdom when I was there recently, looking at their poverty policies. What the government is trying to do, and successive governments have, is to say that work is the only way out of poverty. And what we're going to do to make that happen is to make any form of government assistance, like New Start, increasingly unsustainable. There's going to be no incentive whatsoever, no matter how badly off you are, to stay on this allowance. That's the mentality that's behind it. And while it's fine to prioritise employment, it should be the case, nonetheless, there is always going to be a significant percentage of the population who are extremely badly off, who suffer from mental depression or have chronic family or other problems, who simply can't drop things and go out to work. And they are going to be left in increasingly miserable conditions, which are not at all fitting for a rich, advanced country like Australia.
Many of our listeners would be familiar with your brother, Richard Alston. You have very different worldviews. How do you get along?
We get along very well, but we keep the politics out of it. It's true that we see things very differently. I've long ago given up trying to convert him, and I suspect he's done the same thing, but we get on fine.
And that's the UN Special Rapporteur for Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, Philip Alston. Australian researchers have captured on video the moment a malaria parasite tried to invade red blood cells and watched as two antibodies blocked its spread. It was used to confirm work by the Oxford University, which is considered a major advance and may pave the way for an effective vaccine for the mosquito-borne disease. Alison Branley reports.
Growing up in Sri Lanka, Rasika Kumarasinghe was just 4 when she first had malaria.
I remember being really sick, and then you have this alternative hot and shivers, then vomiting and you can't eat.
So when she became a doctor, she specialised in infectious diseases. She's now part of an Australian team from Victoria's Burnet Institute that's captured on video the moment when a malaria parasite invades a red blood cell. It's helped fellow researchers at Oxford University prove the role of 2 key antibodies in blocking that invasion, getting researchers a major step closer to an effective malaria vaccine. Burnet Institute Head of Cell Imaging, Dr. Paul Gilson, says a vaccine could be critical in helping some of the 200 million people globally each year who develop malaria but have trouble accessing treatment.
Tragically, there's almost 500,000 deaths a year from malaria, mostly of pregnant women, their babies and young children. At the moment, we have drugs and we have mosquito control measures, but having a really good vaccine would go a long way to helping eliminate malaria.
Dr. Gilson says the Oxford team approached Victoria's Burnet Institute because of its expertise filming malaria parasites. It can prepare and treat malaria parasites in a lab and video them through a microscope using a technique called microscopy.
Our research helped in that we're able to sort of solve the puzzle that they had, which was that these antibodies are doing something, but we don't know what it is. We think it might be slowing the invasion process down, but we don't have the capacity to physically look at the parasites.
Professor Matt Higgins is a molecular parasitologist at Oxford University. He says the Burnet team's contribution led to them getting their findings published in the journal Cell.
What they were able to show is that the antibodies, these helping antibodies, slowed down the invasion process, and that just gave a longer time for the other antibodies, the protective antibodies, to bind and stop this process. Because if the parasite can't get inside our red blood cells, it can't make us sick, and it also is then unable to be passed on to other people.
Sri Lanka eliminated malaria with mosquito control measures in 2016. Dr. Kumarasinghe hopes her work means it will soon be wiped out globally.
It's a big deal. It's revolutionary, actually.
That's Dr. Rasika Kumarasinghe ending that report by Alison Branley. The World Health Organization has declared an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo a public health emergency of international concern. It says it's seen signs of the possible spread of the epidemic and that a recent case in the city of Goma is a worrying development. With more, here's Rachel Mealy.
The deadly disease has killed more than 1,600 people in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the past year. Last weekend, a preacher from Butembo took a bus to Goma. He came down with symptoms of Ebola and died soon after arriving in the city of 2 million people on the border with Rwanda. WHO Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says another woman died after crossing into Uganda.
These two events represent a concerning geographical expansion of the virus.
A public health emergency of international concern is the highest level of alarm the WHO can sound. It's designed to get the attention of the international community and prompt big injections of cash for the fight from wealthy countries. The WHO chief says he doesn't recommend restrictions on travel or trade in the region, which have been shown to hamper the fight against Ebola.
Closing borders could have disastrous consequences for the lives and livelihoods of the people who cross the border every day for trade, education, or to visit relatives.
He says border closure often forces people to use informal and unmonitored border crossings and actually increases the potential for the spread of disease. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said in a statement,
"While it doesn't change the reality on the ground for victims or partners engaged in the response, we hope it will bring the international attention that this crisis deserves."
Nicole Fasina is the Regional Ebola Operations Coordinator for the Red Cross. In a recorded message on Twitter earlier in the week, she responded to the news that the outbreak had reached Goma.
"This is why we've been doing preparedness work. We have safe and dignified burial teams ready, the decontamination base ready. Today, in fact, we're training healthcare workers who are receiving these individuals at the health clinics, so reminding them of proper procedures and signs and symptoms."
The WHO Committee on Ebola says 12 new cases are being reported every day. While a vaccine is available, relatively few people in the region have been inoculated.
Rachel Mealy. One of Huawei's top global executives says the federal government's decision a year ago to ban the Chinese telco giant from supplying equipment to Australia's 5G mobile network was wrong. Walter Gee is Huawei's Western Europe chief and he's visiting Australia to reassure local partners. He says there's no proof Australia's national security would have been jeopardised by his company's involvement and that it doesn't share information with Chinese intelligence. Mr. Gee's trip here comes as a British parliamentary committee found a decision to block Huawei in the UK was not a proportionate response to any potential security threats. In his only broadcast interview, Walter Gee's spoken with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Australia is a passionate country. People are very friendly. So we are committed to Australia, especially.
Are you angry or upset at the Australian government's decision to exclude Huawei from supplying equipment to the 5G network?
Of course, we are not happy for the current situation because we always try our best to comply to local law. As you might know, we are always optimistic for the future. We look at the world in a different way.
But was that decision to exclude Huawei from the 5G network interpreted as insulting or a decision that didn't make any sense in Shenzhen?
Indeed, we have not been told any reason why we're excluded for 5G.
You're in Australia here visiting business partners and potential partners. What sort of damage has been done to Huawei's reputation, given that intelligence agencies and governments like the US and Australia are deeply suspicious about Huawei?
Huawei has been run in more than 170 countries in the past 30 years. We have been investing huge money in R&D. Last year, we have invested $15 billion US dollars to R&D. So that's why in 5G technologies, we are much leading in the industry.
But just to be clear, does Huawei take any direction at all from the Chinese government? What can you say to reassure the Australian government that sensitive information wouldn't be tapped and wouldn't be handed over?
Huawei is an international company. We're still a private-owned company. So there's no any reason for Huawei not comply with local law.
So you don't take any direction at all from Beijing or Chinese?
Of course not.
No direction at all? So has the Australian government got it wrong in banning Huawei from supplying that equipment to the 5G network?
Definitely. I believe it's a wrong decision. We believe that Huawei can bring much more innovation to Australian market.
But the Australian government believes it has the evidence and is concerned about national security. Have you met with any Australian government officials or the Communications Minister Paul Fletcher to break the ice and to get some sort of deal back on track?
We have been not told any clear reason. So it's important for the Australian government to make the right decision based on the facts.
But in Australia, you do have a big problem because Huawei Australia's chairman John Lord has said that the doors of government are effectively closed. Do you have any hope of that situation changing?
From our side, we continue to be open to talk if they have any concern. We are trusted. Australia, they can trust Huawei.
Are you able to give an assurance that Australia's national security would not be compromised by cooperating with Huawei?
Of course, from Huawei's side, we put security as the first priority. Of course, we are safe.
But does the point come, given the tensions with Australia, that Huawei might decide to simply cut its losses and simply leave Australia for more friendly markets?
Of course not. We are committed in Australian market. We are committed.
So Huawei wouldn't consider leaving Australia. It plans to tough it out.
Of course not. We believe the consumers, they will make the right choice based on the facts.
China is Australia's most important trading partner. So do you see any double standards or even hypocrisy in Australia being suspicious about Huawei?
I'm not able to give any comments or any opinion in terms of the government.
And that's Walter Gee, Huawei's chief in Western Europe, and he was speaking there with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. And a government spokesman says it stands by its 5G decision last August and that its position is based on domestic and national interests. Dog owners spend a fortune feeding their mutts, but are they prepared to shell out more to look after their pets' wild cousins? A group of scientists says a levy on pet food could fund non-lethal methods to control dingoes. With more, here's Gavin Coote.
As Australia's only native dog, the dingo sits uncomfortably at the top of the food chain. They're a central part of our bush folklore, and it's argued they play an important ecological role in the landscape. But at the same time, they can represent an existential threat for people living on the land. And at Ewan Station, 6 hours from Perth, where many of the dingoes roam, even Roscoe Folks Taylor has mixed feelings about the animal.
There's both dingoes and dogs in this country, and I don't hate them. You can't really, it'll wear you out. You'll end up mentally exhausted if you do that. I hate what they do. I hate the toll they take on the land.
This toll is both economic and emotional, as dingoes can be devastating for livestock across Australian farms. Part of the solution has long involved fences. By installing about 80 kilometres of fencing, the Folks Taylors were able to keep dingoes and wild dogs off their property and return the station to its 150-year history of successful sheep production. But it came with a price tag of $250,000.
As an individual property, we've chosen to do our own fencing. We think that's our only long-term solution.
It's estimated landowners and governments spend up to $250 million each year controlling dingoes, which include other wild dogs, which are often a hybrid of a dingo. A team of researchers has now put forward a bold proposal for funding these measures in the form of a so-called dingo levy. Griffith University's Rob Appleby is one of the study's authors.
And that could obviously be levied either on their food or on the purchase of the dog themselves, trying to leverage that affinity that people naturally have for their own dog and co-opting that a little bit in favour of their, you know, wild cousins.
The study finds Australians spend more than $10 billion a year on buying and feeding dogs. Rob Appleby says imposing a levy able to raise $30 million a year wouldn't be a huge task.
It's essentially a way for us to not compete with existing funding. We're trying to instead develop a parallel or alternative form of funding specifically on non-lethal management.
And that's Griffith University's Rob Appleby ending Gavin Coote's report. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. More and more Australians are deciding not to have children. Everyone's got their reasons, and at the extreme end of that spectrum, there's even a movement in favour of voluntary human extinction as a desperate measure to save the planet.
So could it be good news that the birth rate is tanking? That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.